challenge India over its human rights abuses. Earlier this year, the politicians in Washington were briefed by a group called Genocide Watch, who said that they were increasingly concerned about what was happening in India. And the precursor to genocidal actions are taking place in India. So, you know, Amnesty might express shock, but really, this is nothing new. Since Modi took over the country, he has taken it down a very dark path in which he has targeted the country's 200 million Muslims. They only make up about 14% of the country, but they're still a significant minority.
Mr. Ripley, how do you see the future of the Bharatiya Janata Party, given its recruitment prospects?
You know, I was reading up on the BJP just the other day, and the membership is in the tens of millions. The membership of the BJP is larger than most countries in the world today. I think there are only seven other countries whose population exceeds the BJP membership. So this is what we're talking about, a huge organization. And they've just started another recruiting drive to get even more members on board the world's most populous democracy, which is India. And I don't think there's any holding back of this party. There are some decent people within its ranks, but it is, at the moment, it seems to be in the control of Islamophobic right-wing nutters, is the only way I can describe their actions against Muslims and other minority groups in India.
Mrs. Ridley, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Munawar says, hate speech is achievement, protest is crime, media is court, bulldozer is justice. New India. Y. Satya Kumar, who says, after every Friday, there comes a Saturday. After every riot, there comes a bulldozer. At Suicidal says, the treatment of Muslims in India is becoming a genocide and people aren't talking about it at all. Indian Muslims are being kicked out of their homes, arrested, assaulted and murdered just for their religion. And people seem to just ignore it. At Shekhar Gupta says, strong view from columnist at Asim Ali 6, who argues, Muslims in India are semi-citizens now. Political and civil rights have been bulldozed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Bangladesh was once one of the poorest regions of Pakistan, but almost four decades after gaining independence from Pakistan, the country, which was considered a burden, turned into one of the fastest-growing economies of the world and the fastest in Asia, with a GDP growth rate of almost 8% before the land of the Bengal tiger was hit by COVID-19. Things started changing with the increase of COVID-19 cases in Europe and the US. Various brands started cancelling orders and Bangladeshi factories lost around $100 million per day and lost more than $1.5 billion by March 2020. Now, with rising global fuel prices and supply chain problems, Bangladesh is facing difficulties similar to those which Sri Lanka faced before it defaulted on its national debt. Currently, troubled by a rising trade deficit and foreign debt burden, Bangladesh, a country which was enjoying what some called an economic miracle, now seem to be in dire straits, and some even worry that it can become the next Sri Lanka.
Bangladesh was once regarded as the fastest-growing economy of the world, and the country managed to outpace Pakistan, India, and even China in terms of growth, as Bangladesh turned itself into an export-driven economy, becoming one of the top garments exporters in the world before COVID-19 shook the world. The COVID-19 pandemic has been followed by a global economic crisis across the world. The International Monetary Fund forecasts global growth in 2022 at 4.4%, but these projections are being revised downwards, also due to the conflict in Ukraine and the economic sanctions on Russia. After global markets reopened, the conflict in Ukraine created inflationary pressure all around the world by increasing food and oil prices, with countries like Sri Lanka running out of petrol, medicine, and foreign currency reserves amid an acute balance of payments crisis. Now, some say Bangladesh seems to be moving in a similar direction with a serious trade deficit. Bangladesh imported goods worth over $61.5 billion in the first 9 months of the 2021-2022 fiscal year, rising almost 44% compared to the same period the year before. But exports and remittances, which are needed to cover the cost of these imports, have dropped in the first 4 months of 2022, causing an estimated deficit of $10 billion this year. This comes with Dhaka's foreign exchange reserves also falling by $6 billion from $48 billion to $42 billion, that is, over the past 8 months. Some experts are worried that this may drop by another $4 billion in the coming months.
COVID-19 and US sanctions over the conflict in Ukraine have not only put Bangladesh's economy under threat, but India, Pakistan and other Southeast Asian countries are also feeling the economic strain. India's edible oil market and exports are suffering, while Bangladesh-Russia trade has taken a hit due to sanctions. While the economy of Bangladesh is recoverable and India enjoys cheap Russian oil without facing the wrath of the West sanctions, Pakistani citizens see crushing inflation not only because of the rising oil prices, but also because of pressure from the International Monetary Fund, which has led to the devaluation of the Pakistani currency, increasing taxes, and an acute shortage of foreign currency reserves, bringing the Pakistani economy on the brink of collapse.
On June the 10th, the foreign currency reserves held by the State Bank of Pakistan were recorded at an alarming $8.9 billion, which is roughly a 50% drop from August and only enough to pay for less than 2 months of imports. This has threatened to spill over into an all-out economic crisis unless the policymakers of Pakistan secure emergency financing, which has been refused by the IMF, International Monetary Fund. Many question why the reserves fell in the first place, and many experts have placed the blame on the IMF, the international financial institution which provides lending to countries in need. Loans provided by the IMF come with strict terms and conditions, such as those which were placed on Pakistan. Pakistan was first required to devalue its currency, which it did, and consequently saw its currency fall by 27% as a result. Since Pakistan relies heavily on oil imports, this devaluation ultimately led to a massive increase in oil import costs, after which the IMF demanded that the country remove all fuel subsidies provided to its citizens. This was set as a condition to unlock the remaining $3 billion of a pre-existing loan by the multilateral lender. This led to an overall crushing increase in oil prices, which led to inflation skyrocketing in the country at 27.82%, according to official data, the highest in 14 years. Despite complying with most of its demands, the IMF has rejected Pakistan's appeals for releasing the funds required desperately by the country's collapsing economy. Amid the depleting foreign currency reserves and crashing economy and government forecasts of its trade deficit widening to a record $45 billion in the fiscal year ending in June, Pakistan's total foreign debt servicing is already projected to top $23 billion. Experts claim Pakistani policymakers can help avert this disaster by buying cheaper oil from countries such as Iran and Russia. But they're afraid Pakistan will face devastating consequences from the West. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan was allegedly ousted for trying to build close relations with Russia, and even the current finance minister, Miftah Ismail, implied that the country would be sanctioned if they tried to buy Russian oil. Only time will tell whether Pakistan's economy can recover.
Now to discuss this further, we are joined by Mr. Qazi Fahim Ahmed, a research intern at the East Asia Study Center at the University of Dhaka. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed. Now, do you think Bangladesh's economy is in trouble because of the serious trade deficit? And if so, why?
You know, I think Bangladesh, like other developing countries around the world, is facing economic difficulties due to the increasing trade deficit and higher inflation rate in the face of the pandemic and after then the Russian-Ukraine war. And due to the high oil price and interruption in the supply chain, import costs have actually increased drastically for Bangladesh and other developing countries. Currently, Bangladesh's trade deficit has actually surpassed its previous history, amounting to $25 billion US dollar in the last 9 months, which is actually 9.25% higher than that of the full fiscal year in the previous year. However, the export earnings of Bangladesh is also rising in significantly. Bangladesh's export earnings have almost reached its target for the current year, which is actually $43.5 billion for the fiscal year 2022. And in only 10 months, thanks to the growing global demand for the apparels and shifting of a good number of work orders from China. In April, for example, the exports clocked for around $4 billion US dollar for the 8th consecutive year month, with a little over 51% year-on-year growth.
Mr. Ahmed, there are claims that Bangladesh, like Sri Lanka, has also taken on foreign loans in recent years to fund what critics call white elephant projects, which are expensive but unprofitable. Now, what do you have to say about these projects contributing to economic problems of the country?
Look, during the last decade, the Sri Lankan government actually implemented a lot of unnecessary mega projects, like the Hambantota Seaport, Rajapaksa International Airport, Chinese Colombo City, and some unviable highways, which are called white elephants projects by the critics. While most of these projects are not that much profitable, they have been also implemented with high interest loans from China. And also, the government of Sri Lanka actually collected almost $9 billion US dollars from the international market in exchange for debt bonds, which are short-term in nature and comes with higher interest rates of almost 8%. The government in Bangladesh actually has taken a totally different approach. Here, they have taken some well-calculated and viable mega projects. For example, the Padma Bridge, which is set to be opened on 25 June this month. This bridge will help increase the annual GDP of the southern part of Bangladesh by almost 2%. And the overall GDP of the country by almost 1%. It is also important to note that the Padma Bridge actually was fully self-financed by the government of Bangladesh. According to the assessment of a Policy Research Institute, the Padma Bridge has the potential to achieve 29% growth in the construction sector, 9.5% growth in the agriculture, and 8% in the manufacturing and transport sector of Bangladesh. Consequently, the completion of the other infrastructure projects in Bangladesh, like the Kornofuli Tunnel project and Matarbari electricity project, will also boost the economy and further bring investment to Bangladesh. Moreover, the bulk of the foreign loans that Bangladesh have taken are from the multilateral lenders, like World Bank, ADB, IDB, and JICA. And the interest rates of such loans are very low, like 1.4%. With grace periods and long repayment system.
Mr. Ahmed, thank you for being on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
At P. Bushan 1 says, as our economy sinks with unemployment at an all-time high, per capita income below Bangladesh, and India sinking in all indices, human development, happiness, press freedom, health, education, environment and protection, the BJP is obsessed with promoting hate against Muslims and weakening India. At SRGMKO1 says, hashtag Pakistan on the verge of complete bankruptcy. There is an urgent need to sign a charter on the economy, says Planning Minister Ihsan Iqbal. Steve Henker says, as Pakistan's inflation soars to 45% per year by my measure, no one knows the price of anything. What's PM Sharif's plan? Slash fuel subsidies to secure another IMF loan. Spoiler alert, the PM's program might woo IMF, but like all IMF plans in Pak, it won't work.
And that was our episode on the ongoing oppression of Muslims in India amid recent protests and economic fallout in South Asia. We will meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. The house is the best place to nurture ourselves. It might be hard, but it is useful. Now, this case must be more tangible in the life of religious people. In other words, house and family are the best ways towards religious perfection. If we, as religious people, want to know the depths of our religious beliefs, we have to test them in our family life inside the house. The best examples are our behavior with our children, spouses and parents. Positive and negative behaviors in family life are the best criteria to know the true nature of our religious beliefs. Believing people are all just and fair inside a mosque or Husseiniya. In such holy places, all the people observe moral etiquettes and act according to Islam. However, it is inside the house that people, even the believing ones, show their true nature and self. As the famous sentence says, the true just person is the one behind whom his own family members pray. A Muslim who is accepted by his own family is for sure accepted by the general community. In other words, the true essence and depths of one's beliefs, religion, and ethics are tested inside the house and through relations with family members. Family life inside the house is the best nurturing place for both the adults and children. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Got an enthusiast protest that now is the time for mourning, not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. The article you're about to hear has been written by Nicholas Kristof, a former New York Times opinion columnist. Nicholas Kristof was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Oregon this year. The piece is titled, "These Gun Reforms Could Save 15,000 Lives. We Can Achieve Them." Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning and not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. But we're tired of commemorating gun violence in America only with thoughts and prayers. We didn't respond to the 9/11 attacks only with moments of silence, or to Pearl Harbor just with lowered flags and memorial services. No, we resolved to act, even though these were hard challenges with no perfect solutions. Gun policy is likewise complicated and politically vexing, and we're not going to make everyone safe. Still, experts suggest that over time, we plausibly could reduce gun deaths by a third, or 15,000 lives saved annually, with a series of pragmatic limits on firearms and those who can get them. Instead, we're paralyzed in ways that threaten our democracy and our well-being. American children and American teenagers are 57% more likely to die young compared with children and teenagers in other advanced countries. And guns are one important reason. One study found that Americans aged between 15 and 19 are 82 times more likely to be shot dead than similarly aged teenagers in our peer countries. Let's just acknowledge that what we're doing isn't working and we need new approaches. So what's a way forward? This will be painful for many of my fellow liberals, but I suggest that we work harder to engage centrists, talk about gun safety rather than gun control, and jump into the weeds. Social scientists suggest complexifying an issue to reduce polarization, and sure enough, I find that I can sometimes have productive conversations with gun enthusiasts if we focus on technocratic details. For example, consider the minimum age to buy or possess a gun. The suspects in both the Uvalde, Texas and Buffalo, New York shootings were only 18 years old, and that's not surprising. Americans aged between 18 and 20 account for 4% of the population, but 17% of those known to have committed a murder. In Wyoming, one of the most pro-gun states in America, the minimum age to buy a handgun is 21. Overall, one-third of states limit purchase of a handgun to those who are aged 21 or older, according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. If we say that teenagers can't buy alcoholic drinks, isn't it worth having a conversation about whether they should be able to buy Glock 19 handguns and AR-15 style rifles? One study found that 17% of all firearm offenders obtained guns legally, but would not have been able to do so if their state required handgun purchasers to be at least 21. Even more would have been ineligible to buy guns if there had been limits imposed on those with drug and alcohol convictions. That's another conversation to have. We typically don't allow people with felony convictions to possess firearms. And wouldn't it also make sense to bar purchases by someone with a recent misdemeanor conviction for drug or alcohol abuse, for violence, or for stalking? Only 10 states bar people with stalking convictions from buying guns. We know that people going through breakups are particularly at risk to themselves and to their ex-partners. So why not pass red flag laws that allow guns to be removed from someone who is undergoing a mental health crisis or subject to a domestic violence protection order? Even former President Donald Trump has backed red flag laws. What about universal background checks to buy a firearm? Opinion polls suggest that gun owners themselves overwhelmingly favor universal background checks. Yet 22% of firearms are obtained without them. In much of America, there is a more thorough review of people adopting a rescue dog than of those buying assault rifles. And should we really continue to allow people on the no-fly list to buy firearms but not board a plane. These are pragmatic steps that won't eliminate gun violence or avert every shooting incident, but they can make our country a bit safer. And while they will feel flimsy and unsatisfactory to many, they would at least break the paralysis on sensible gun policy. They would indicate that some progress is possible at a time when gun-related deaths have been worsening. Nineteen elementary school children died in the Texas school shooting on Tuesday, 24th of May, along with two teachers. 9 days earlier, six people were shot in a California church, one fatally, and five were shot, two fatally, at a Texas flea market. A day before that, a gunman killed 10 people in a racist attack on black shoppers in Buffalo, New York. When New Zealand experienced a mass shooting in 2019, that country acted in just 26 days to tighten gun laws. But here in America, it has been 56 years since one of the first gun massacres, the University of Texas Tower shooting in 1966, that claimed the lives of 17 people. Yet we know that gun safety is not a hopeless task, because just about every other country manages to do better. The Onion satirical website regularly responds to mass shootings with the headline, "No way to prevent this," says only nation where this regularly happens. It has a point. The result of our paralysis is that just since 1975, more Americans have died from guns, including suicides, murders and accidents, than in all the wars in United States history, going back to the American Revolution. Is the Second Amendment an obstacle? Perhaps to some degree. But most of us, judges included, recognize that we need some limits on weapons. Few believe that private citizens should be able to possess mortars, or that it's okay for 15-year-old teenagers to buy assault rifles. The practical question is a difficult one of where precisely to draw the lines. The truth is that we're not going to ban guns in the United States any more than we're going to ban alcohol, motorcycles, hunting knives, cigarettes or other products that can be deadly. Screaming maximalist fights about gun control versus the Second Amendment have created a political stalemate as we continue to lose 45,000 lives a year to gun violence. That's 123 lives lost in a single day. This does not happen in other countries. Japan typically loses a single-digit number of people to gun murders in a year. We lost twice that in a single school shooting incident on Tuesday. Whenever I write about guns, I get indignant protests. Cars kill about as many Americans a year as guns do, but you don't ban cars. No, but we do work to make vehicles safer. Auto safety is a boring, non-politicized endeavor driven by engineers that has enabled us to live with dangerous objects, that is cars, and reduce the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by more than 90% of the population since 1923. Likewise, we have a non-politicized safety process for ladders, swimming pools and toys. 8 pages of federal regulations on ladders, which kill around 100 people a year, with safety campaigns including making March Ladder Safety Month. Why can't we take a similar evidence-based approach to guns, not aiming for mass confiscation, but for reducing the carnage? For example, we require a license to operate a car, so why not a license to buy a gun? That's the law in Massachusetts, which has one of the lowest gun mortality rates in America. And while Massachusetts is a liberal state where one might expect tighter gun laws, Permits are also required through a simpler process to buy a handgun in North Carolina. Texas had such a requirement, but last year approved a new law ending the mandate for a license to carry a handgun. Addressing gun violence must also include a strong mental health component, as the military recognizes in its strategy to reduce suicides. Likewise, social programs like Cure Violence and Becoming a Man aren't specifically about guns, but do appear to reduce gun violence. There are many other steps that we can take. Safe storage requirements for firearms keep guns from children and thieves. Some 380,000 guns are stolen annually from private owners in the United States. We need to crack down on ghost guns assembled by the purchaser from parts without a serial number or any background checks. We must curb the next technology, firearms made by 3D printers. Let's be driven by evidence, which means more research. What about voluntary gun buybacks to reduce the pool of 400 million guns already in America? What about warning labels and guns, cautioning that a firearm in the house increases the risk of a gun death? What about a tax on guns to cover some of the external costs of their misuse, just as we tax cigarettes? What about universal background checks to buy ammunition? How about waiting periods or a limit of 2 gun purchases a month per person? How about a crackdown on straw purchasers who equip gangs? America is losing ground to guns. An estimated 18.8 million firearms were sold in the United States last year. The United States already has the highest number of firearms per capita by far. Yemen, in the midst of a civil war, ranks second. American civilians appear to have more assault weapons, the civilian versions, than the United States military has of the automatic version. So spare us the pious calls to avoid politics. Rather, let's supplement thoughts and prayers with concrete steps based on nerdy evidence gathering, based on hard conversations with people we disagree with to reduce gun deaths so that elementary schools need not be graveyards.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in the studio our speaker, Brother Abdullah Al-Musawi. He's an Islamic researcher in the House of Ilmi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming, brother. In our previous sessions, we talked about that there could be different behaviors children have, and parents should understand that something is wrong with their child. So as a parent, what are the signs that I should be looking for that indicate that there's a problem with my child?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. When it comes to children and behavior, it's not a one thing. Rather, it's a number of things that we need to look for in order to make sure that we diagnose the right behavior. So sometimes I'm not just looking at him in terms of his personal life, but sometimes we need to also consider the environment that he lives in, the family that he lives with, the society that he lives in. So there are a lot of things involved that as parents we need to be very aware of in order to see what could be going wrong with my child's behavior. So there are a number of things that cause it. For example, if we look at it at a personal level, like the child himself, there could be a number of causes to indicate a behavior change. For example, stress itself plays a factor that when you have a child who is stressed, obviously,
yes,
is going to affect his behavior.
Yeah.
If there's a fear factor, is going to affect his behavior. Lack of concentration will affect his behavior. Whether, for example, he gets busy with himself, running away from his problems. So there are a lot of signs that I can go on and on.
Yeah.
That indicates a problem with a child. So sometimes we look at the signs,
yeah,
that are within the child himself, if, through the things that he does. And these ones are easier to spot, easier to find. Just by observing the child's behavior, you can tell that something is going wrong. So like I said, sometimes even biting one's nails or sucking thumbs, or sometimes depending on the child's age, sometimes like urinating on themselves or in the bed, or what, as we call, wetting their beds. Or, for example, their anger levels, them being, I don't know, bit violent with other kids, lack of obedience to their parents. So all these signs indicate that there's a problem when it comes to their behavior. This is when it comes to on their personal level. Also, at the same time, when we look at signs, we have to consider the family as well. So sometimes the child himself might not be causing any problems himself. Rather, it is the environment that he lives in.
So So we will talk on that environment after a very short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about Islamic upbringing and what are the signs that parents could spot to find out that their child is going through some problem. So, Brother Mousavi, you were saying that a family environment also plays a role.
Yes. So when we look at the family itself, because the child himself, obviously, he's not independent. Rather, he's dependent on his parents. So whatever happens in the family would also affect his behavior. So there are a number of things that we need to keep in mind or look for to see if they are happening to the child. Sometimes when you have spouses, they're constantly fighting with one another, constantly nagging and constantly fighting.
All right.
Sometimes you see the child not caring at all. Like he would pretend as nothing is happening. That's a problem because the child should react to such an argument or fight in the house. So when the child does not interact to these problems, that indicates there's a change in behavior. When the child, for example, constantly submits to his parents, sometimes we look at this as a good sign as parents, because if my child is listening and is doing everything that I want from him, that's a good thing. Not always. I mean, if things are going right and he's doing it, being submissive to his parents due to the fact that he understands what he's doing, all good and well.
Well, could you a little explain that? Because, you know, there are some parents who think that, well, who in fact feel proud that whatever I'm telling to my child is listening and doing and all. But you're saying doing that all the time could be a problem.
Yeah, so it's a sword with two edges, right? So we as parents, we always want our child to be absolutely obedient. Now, this obedience, sometimes it happens because we've taught the child the correct way of dealing with things and acting correctly. So yeah. He's obedient not because he's forced to, not because he has other issues, no, because he understands what needs to be done, and he's doing it. He knows that he needs to fix up his room, for example, do his homework, wash the dishes, clean the house, or at least his room. You know, he's doing things that we want him based because we taught him the right proper manner. So this mm-hmm. is the good side of things. Sometimes you see the child, no, he's constantly submissive, like, whatever you say to him, he's like, okay, sure. He just moves on. So that indicates that sometimes that the child himself might be suffering a trauma of some sort or a problem of some sort. He is not being able to express himself. He's not being able to talk to his parents. He's not being able to solve the issue himself. So his way in order to deal with this issue is just him being submissive. So like we said, so submissive itself, it plays, like I said, it plays two roles. Sometimes it's good if it's done the right manner. If it's done not because we've taught him the correct way, he's just quiet, you know, because we have these kids who are just quiet and they just do whatever you want them, and they just want to get you out of their way. Mm-hmm. They don't want to argue with you. They want to fight with you. They just kind of want to shove you away. Then that indicates a problem. So as parents, we need to understand, even for a child, he needs to be able to give his opinion in matters of things, or at least show his likes and dislikes.
All right.
It's not that whatever we give him, he's going to say, okay, sure.
Okay, all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
well, that indicates a problem. And you said, like, there are so many things parents could notice. They could be not one, they could be many things. We can summarize them. You said that biting nails, sucking thumbs, urinating in the bed, or the anger level, or being violent with other kids, fighting and not reacting. And the most important, you said, was listening, being obedient all the times, not showing their opinion. Well, brother, I'll be talking to you, but after a very short break. To listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the signs that could indicate that there's a problem with your child. Yes, brother, you were talking about these signs.
All right, so we're still discussing the signs that could happen inside the family framework that we have to be very mindful of that our children don't have. If they have, then we have to be alert to the fact that there's a problem. One of the issues that also a lot of parents see as a positive thing in the child or in the children is the fact that they're being too shy. So you have a lot of kids who are very shy to be at least honest with their parents or speak with their parents, and they get embarrassed very quickly. They back off very quickly. Sometimes, like, even they might change color when it comes, like, you know, to their faces out of shyness. As we say, they turn red. So this sort of shyness, it's required, is good for a person to become shy. But there are not always. Places where a person needs to be himself. Like mm-hmm. Because that, if that develops as he grows older, that could become a huge problem. Yep. Where he becomes more submissive to people because he's shy. He can't express his needs, and he can't reject and object to things because he's too shy. So whatever people tell him, he will do. So that could cause a lot of problems as he grows older. So if you have a very shy child, mm-hmm. Usually that is because of the environment that he lives in the house, that's causing him to be in this state. Sometimes you see the child, for example, is in the state of destruction. like inside the house. Sometimes I've seen a lot of children, for example, they like to break things, they like to destroy things just for fun. We think it's for fun, but in fact this means that this child has a problem that he's trying to express in another way, where sometimes he breaks his own toys, sometimes he destroys toys within the house, sometimes he breaks his mom or his dad's stuff. So that also indicates there's a problem. And also, as a child grows older and older, one of the things that we're currently suffering from is that they start to develop their sense of sexuality at a very, very quick, rapid age. And sometimes the parents play a massive role in that. And this point is so sensitive that even the Quran mentioned it, that it says that when you are with your spouses, make sure that you don't let kids come into your rooms while you're sleeping, because they might see things they shouldn't see. So this also plays a huge role. Now, alhamdulillah, kids don't have to come to our rooms to see. They can see by themselves at their own time, which is a massive problem.
Yeah.
So that sexual development at a very rapid age is also a problem that parents need to be aware of. But I mean, obviously, that's a topic by itself. But we're talking about things that the parents themselves could contribute to the behavior of the child. And this is one of the things.
Yes.
And like I said, the Quran mentioned it very clearly and very honestly as well, not just clearly. So parents need to be very aware of, because that could cause a child a lot of problems. Another issue that we see with children is when you see a child who is disobedient, most of the times the cause for that is the parents themselves. So usually when a wife and a husband themselves, they're constantly fighting, the child kind of loses respect for either both or one of the parents. For example, if the father, which is the male figure in the house, a figure of authority, if the mother is constantly yelling at him and shouting at him and calling him names, the child would have no respect for him. So if the father would say something to the child would not listen because he doesn't see him as an authority figure anymore.
Yeah.
And vice versa. When the mother's constantly yelled at and abused by the father, then the child would not feel anything towards her either.
Well,
so if we have this disobedience in children, then we have to revisit our own relationship as a husband and a wife to see what is it that we're doing wrong that's causing the child this issue. So also that's an indication there's a problem in behavior.
These were very important signs that one could really look for. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us. Please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our sessions again on our official website, that's parstoday.com. Go to Call of Islam. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.